I'd like to call to order the meeting of the Finance and Administration Committee. If everybody could take their seats. Okay. Yep. All right, we're going to get this meeting started. First of all, we have an agenda before us. Are there any questions or addition or changes to the agenda as presented? If not, we'll move forward with the agenda as presented. Next is the approval of the minutes of March 14th, Finance and Administration Committee meeting. Are there any changes, suggestions, modifications to the minutes? Donna, entertain a motion to move.
Do you want a movement?
Yes.
I'd move the approval of the minutes.
I'll move by Ms. Hines.
Second.
Second by Ms. Bowser. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. We only have one very important action item to consider today, and that is to consider the adoption of the General Manager's and CEO's proposed budget for fiscal year 2014. Just to recount what has happened over the last few months, beginning in September, the staff has come before the committee to review different elements of the budget proposal as it has been prepared, and that culminated with a presentation last January by our General Manager of the proposed FY 2014 operating and capital budget. So at previous meetings, we had gone through various issues in terms of revenue, cost estimates, a specific discussion about the capital budget that would kind of allow us to talk through many of those very important issues. The proposed budget supports the board approved strategic goals and funds the business plan actions in support of our strategic plan. Importantly for our customers, this budget offers more and improved service with the launch of the Silver Line, expansion of our bus service, and introduction of a new business model for Metro Access without a fare increase. Also of interest to our customers, the budget also provides for continued focus on safety, on our safety and rebuilding program. But it also begins to support future growth by laying the foundation for Metro 2025 as described in our Momentum Strategic Plan. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Kissel, who will walk us through the budget proposal in much more detail.
Great, thank you very much, and we're happy to be here. This has been culminating in about a seven-month process, I think, which has been very good in terms of improving the process, learning about it, and educating our stakeholders about it. Before I start, I just really wanted to introduce three people who have the responsibility of consolidating and preparing the budget. Certainly the budget is the general managers and the executive leadership team are informing what that budget is. But as you can imagine, it's a Herculean effort to actually put all those things together. And Bill Green, who's not the general manager, who's our
– I know, you have a good job, yeah, right.
She's not over here either.
Yeah, I know. He's our managing director for operating and capital budgets. And we have Tom Webster, who Marilyn knows because we stole him from Marilyn. He's the director of our capital budgets, and Vi Davies is the director of our operating budget. Certainly there's a whole host of staff behind them that they get this done, but I wanted to be able to introduce them. So I'll just go right through the third chart, maybe after this chart. So in the past years, our budget discussions really focused on the incremental investment of a $1.7 billion budget. And we've actually turned that around a little bit because really we want to talk about what does $1.7 billion buy you. And the approach allows for a more broader discussion on operating as well as on capital. It talks about what our customers are going to get from our budget, and it'll talk about what the region gets for that dollar amount as well. And so we're actually happy to be at that stage and talking about it in a broad sense. When you change a conversation, it allows us to demonstrate that we are thinking of the long-term needs of the system, and we are managing the significant estimate and investment that is provided by our jurisdictions and the federal government. And we have our customers and the region in mind. So the board adopted a strategic plan, which established actually the framework for which we used to adopt and establish a budget. And it had a set of agreed-to goals. It focused on prioritization of efforts and a prioritization of investments. So the next chart you see, the proposed operating expense budget is $1.7 billion. And I'll just go through very quickly a list of what that gets you. And I know Rob is going to talk a little bit about the capital. But so it funds existing levels of service across all modes. It begins the Silver Line in December 2013 with a significant expansion to our system. It expands service on the Metro Priority Corridor networks in all jurisdictions, and it will reduce travel time, increase reliability, and improve the rider rider comfort and the performance of our system. It continues to work on the Institute's, we've actually looked at fatigue management. The Behavior Resources of Baltimore is developing a new fatigue management system. So it puts together the investments for that, and I believe you're going to see that in the next year or so, the outcome of that. So we actually have seeded a $5 million investment for that in here. It continues the investment in the state of good operations to improve our bus schedule reliability and reduce crowding across all of our systems. And finally, it looks at the employment of a new business model that we have for Metro Access, much improved. In order to provide the right kind of service for our access customers, we have introduced a new business model which provides us a lot more quality assurance over the delivery of that service. I know Christian is very excited about that, and it also will provide much a better level of service to our Metro Access customers. That's not final. Final, we have actually the beginnings of a succession plan which is critical in order to keep the knowledge internally, get knowledge internally outside, and understand how we can develop our talent internally in order to make sure that the groundwork that the general manager has laid and the executive leadership team can continue without a stop. We have not had the luxury of that, and I think the succession planning effort is going to be a very good one. On the capital side, we've updated our capital project delivery plan for the current fiscal year. I know Rob and Bill and myself even have spent a lot of times with the project managers understanding scope, schedule, and delivery rates and expenditure forecasts. And Rob will talk a little bit about that later in terms of what we're getting for that. But I wanted to talk about a really significant improvement this time. We are asking in this budget for the board to adopt a budget authority for what we think is going to be about an $84 million we call rollover. So expenditures that are not going to be made this year for a variety of reasons, which, you know, we can talk through. But and that $84 million has been reprogrammed into the 2014 capital plan. That's a significant improvement from the prior years where, if you recall, last year I think we had a rollover of about $270 million. And what this does is it lays the groundwork for really an expenditure-based budgeting process that we were able to forecast exactly what we think our spending plan is going to be. We put a lot more diligence into our plan, scope, and scheduling on our capital projects. The fact that it's much smaller is actually a great improvement. We will probably come back to the board once we reconcile at the end of the year, but we expect that number to be very small. So our forecasting techniques have gotten quite a bit improved. And then finally, we have reimbursable projects that are required or asked of us to do by each jurisdiction. It totals about $113 million on both sides of the House, actually. That's interesting. And so in there, actually, we have the, as a board directed us in March, we have reached the agreement between Arlington and Alexandria to fund the ongoing expenses associated with the Crystal City Potomac Transit Way Service. And this agreement has the net effect of increasing the operating budget by slightly over $1 million in 2014 and $4 million in the years going forward. With that, I'd like to that's a broad picture, and we'll get into a little bit more detail later, but I'd like to hand it off to Rob Troop to talk about some of the investments that we're making on the capital side and what we get for that.
Thank you, Carol. Good morning. Certainly appreciate the opportunity to come forward and talk a little bit about the capital budget and what we have moving forward for the next fiscal year and also through the six-year plan. Obviously, many investments and initiatives will continue with the capital program. These include returning the railroad to a steady state of maintenance, which is critical and also essential to ensuring the continued safe and reliable service. We look at the track circuit replacement, the 1,000 series car replacement, and the other NTSB initiatives will continue to move at the projected pace, and they're moving well and within schedule and budget. We will continue to invest in these items to ensure a safe operating environment for our passengers and also our employees. Continuing rebuilding efforts is a critical part of a momentum as the network must be stabilized to a state of good repair in order to accommodate any projected increases in passenger levels and train and moving to the eight-car trains. Maintaining our current infrastructure investment level will, in fact, increase in some measures. When we start to move out to the yards, we're looking at moving out to the yards to do a lot of work. And this will be absolutely necessary to support the region's transit requirements. However, because of our success in investing into the infrastructure and getting the transit network closer, and I do say closer to a steady state of maintenance, I don't want to give the idea that we're at there yet, but to the fact that we're closer to a steady state of maintenance, we're able to invest in more forward-facing initiatives, more customer-focused initiatives. And, you know, while installing ties and fasteners and frogs and transmissions and buses is necessary and also somewhat fascinating to me, I recognize that our passengers may not share that specific enthusiasm, and a lot of these items they can't see. So investments that are forward-facing are important because, you know, we have to upgrade those environments that are part of the overall traveling experience. And some of these are obvious. I mean, we're investing in new rail cars and buses, but we're also going to start beginning to focus on the station environment as part of our capital initiatives. One of the things that we're moving forward to, which we spoke about at the last meeting, was station lighting. You know, we have developed new types of lighting, new station designs for lighting, more linear lighting to be able to do the mezzanines. You know, we expect to complete at least 24 mezzanines through the next fiscal year for station lighting, for the underground stations. This is very important to us, and it's part of the overall, network for the passenger experience. The other thing, and one of the most interesting things is, you know, we've been asked to sort of create the model station for the future. And I think probably the best thing I can do is move to the video, if we have a video available for that. I caught him off guard, but.
Metro is preparing for the future. While our rebuilding work continues, our new strategic plan, called Momentum, provides a roadmap to meet the needs of a growing region, all while providing better service for customers. As part of this effort, Metro is planning to test several new design concepts in a single station, a model station of the future, with improved lighting, better information, and improved customer convenience. The station selected for this project is Bethesda. As an underground station with a center platform, it is the hardest type of station to illuminate. Let's take a tour of some of the concepts being considered. Entering from street level, customers could find a brighter and more welcoming atmosphere. New panels would be installed along the walls. Behind them, new high-output fixtures would direct light into the vault ceiling. At the bottom of the escalators, a new anti-slip zone is being considered, an area of high-traction flooring serving as a transition between the entrance and the station tiles. The three existing escalators will be replaced with brand new models for improved reliability. A new information wall could feature metal panels, neatly enclosing the mezzanine equipment, including fare machines, next train displays, ATMs, maps, and more. Customers may notice that Metro Brown has been replaced by stainless steel and light gray to create a lighter, more modern appearance. A new, thinner kiosk would be the centerpiece of the entrance, featuring large digital panels for service information. The thinner kiosk allows for more fare gates for faster entry and exit. The new fare gates would feature new technology and stainless steel enclosures. Overhead, new pendant lighting could be installed to improve brightness. A new stairway will be installed to improve customer circulation. The existing concrete wall may be replaced with glass for improved visibility and brightness. At platform level, the pylons could be replaced with a new design, one that will improve lighting, customer information, and aesthetics. The new design is taller and features four wings radiating from the pylon. All wayfinding signage and arrival information is moved up to the wings, making it easier to see and reducing clutter. Every other pylon would feature a digital information display showing real-time train arrival times. Thanks for joining us on our virtual tour of the future model station. To learn more about Metro's Momentum plan, visit WMATA.com/momentum.
So you can see that we really are focused on the overall customer experience as they enter the station. And again, recognizing information is one of the most critical efforts, not just inside the station, inside the platform, but outside the fare regions and also integrated with the area, you know, so that we can take advantage of those things. you know, commitment, as momentum has moved forward, is it's critical that we take advantage of certain contract efficiencies and the time we have to progress these projects. By establishing the six-year capital plan, we're committing future funds to enable purchase of rail cars and construction of expansion facilities to accommodate new buses and rail cars. These long-term initiatives must be started now in order to accommodate and achieve our 2025 objectives. This budget represents our commitment to the region to ensure not only a continued safe and reliable service, but also enabling sound expansion choices in the future. So, thank you.
Great. So, as we look at contained in the FY 2013 budget, our current budget, the board had adopted a resolution which described what the work plan was for Metro to follow as we build our 14 budget and beyond. And I just wanted to take a moment to take you through some of those areas and talk about the progress that we've made on that. The first one, obviously, is a multi-year business planning. Metro focused on aligning our investment decisions with the strategic plan momentum this year. And the strategic planning framework has proven an invaluable process in the development of our budget proposal. As we discussed over the last 6 months, business plans are now part of Metro's day-to-day responsibility. They link to our strategic plan and to our investments, but equally important, they actually help align our employees' work. And going forward in the future, as we develop those business action plans, which we have this year, we will be using that to inform our performance plans of our employees. So they're very, very connected. And I think that was actually a great outcome of developing multi-business plans. We're moving closer to the integration of our capital investment plans and our operating budget. We've done some of that this year, where if we make an operating investment, we understand what the in the capital investment, we understand what the operating cost of that is. And as we move closer, we'll do more of that total cost of ownership, if you will, resulting from capital investments. This will be critically important as we look to develop funding requirements and actually the price tag, if you will, for the 2025 strategic plan. In terms of the sustainability and efficiencies, we're very mindful of a sustainable system. Rob talked about a couple of the lighting things that we're doing now. We're building all facilities to LEED standards, designing infrastructure to consume less energy. Our escalators and elevators are doing that. And our new buses and rail cars are one of the most energy efficient in the world. We're also becoming more financially stable, and as we continue to seek ways to control our costs. This week, we embarked on an efficiency and effectiveness review, and it will focus on mainly support functions, finance, procurement, budget, non-operational types of functions, to try to understand whether or not we can be more efficient in that and understand how we can be more effective in that in delivering our program to the customer. We will be looking at a couple of areas, non-revenue fleet, the life cycle of a part. You can imagine that's not very exciting, but the fact of the matter is we actually look at it a part. When we purchase a part, it touches a variety of different things. It touches procurement. It touches Rob's engineers. It touches the design of what your infrastructure is going to look at, and it actually really leads us towards more of a quality management system than we have now. So we'll look to update the board as we get, and the general manager, as we get more information on our efficiency review that we're doing. That will probably be in the next 2 or 3 months that review will be completed. And lastly, we're focused on our most important asset, which is our workforce. I know Tanya Moore-McGee, our chief HR officer, will be presenting to the board next week on the work plan for recruiting and our human capital work plan. That we'll talk about, I'm sure, succession planning, recruiting and training and staffing. And we focus on the customer and view all of our actions and initiatives through their eyes. That's very important. I know the general manager has instilled that in this, and the board has as well, that a lot of the investments that we make and the things that we do have to be through a customer's eyes, what their experience is. In terms of business intelligence, a great example of that and how we have adopted that to inform our business decisions was a presentation that you saw last week that Mark Schofield did with regard to rail ridership. In next month, actually, you'll be seeing the bus ridership information. It's a great tool that allows us to inform possibly our scheduling on our rail and bus. It allows us to understand what's happening there, as we have crowd control or events that happen, we can use it to inform the decisions that we have for planning and scheduling and investing. So those are actually very good tools that we've adopted. Planning for the future, we've worked closely with the board on crafting the vision for the future. And as Rob has outlined, we're constantly seeking opportunities to leverage our existing program. The fifth focus is investing in Metro and provides direction for revenue planning. These discussions have begun in the context of the Momentum strategic planning activities, and we're working on them will become a focus as we develop the FY 2015 budget, as we look to revenue opportunities and we look at how we can invest in Metro in a better way. So if you go to the safety and security, our top priorities, I wanted to talk a little bit about, well, before I left that slide, I just wanted to give you a sense that those are adopted goals and framework that we've used to inform our plan. And I think we've done well on all of those items. In terms of building a premier safety and culture system, safety and security are the top priorities of our budget, and it builds on a strong foundation which will enhance our customer and employee safety and security systems throughout the system. As you can see here, and I won't read them all, we've increased our uniform police presence with our budget. We actually have recruits have completed in one of the three jurisdictional training academies and are on schedule to be completed by December on time for the Silver Line opening. We have made great progress on our fatigue management assessment. As I said earlier, we have about a $5 million investment in that for FY14. You'll be seeing those plans. Mr. Daugherty, or Chief Daugherty, will bring those forward to the board to review. We've created a new station lighting project in the CIP, and we will invest about $53 million over the next 6 years to improve lighting at all of our stations. And in FY14, we will upgrade 13 stations and 17 mezzanines. Additionally, Metro has solicited and is currently evaluating a proposed performance contract to provide guaranteed energy savings and guaranteed lighting performance for 10 years in our passenger parking garages. That should be awarded shortly, and that's part of our FY14 plan. And then finally, the $5 million in our 14 plan to complete the Bumpy Tile program. So, targeted service and strategic capital investments improve the reliability and the performance of our system. Priority corridor networks, this will reduce bus travel time, further increase reliability, and improve our customers' comfort and convenience through the expansion of successful priority corridors throughout the district, Maryland, and Virginia. We're adding nearly 60,000 service hours to our annual plan to accommodate for this. And the PCN, the Priority Corridor Network, is a very big initiative. We're looking at limited stop service to reduce travel lines, scheduling modifications to reduce for regular Metro bus to improve reliability. Fleet expansion is in our budget to provide new routes and expand capacity. Comprehensive information systems to meet our customer expectations. Enhanced bus stops with a level of comfort at those stops and convenience. Potential routes, and I know Jack Rico has sent information on this, are going to be Alexandria Fairfax, New Carrollton, Silver Spring, New Carrollton, Fort Totten, and North Capitol, Greenbelt, Twin Brook, and Rhode Island Route 1. Those are just some of the ones that he's focused on. In terms of the state of good operations, with this budget, we will improve our schedule reliability and reduce crowding through new investments in the state of good operations. We'll be adding nearly 30,000 hours of service throughout the system. And again, that's going to be in between Maryland District and Virginia. We've identified candidates that have poor performance, and we are looking at about 36 lines, determining how we can reinvest in those to make them better performance routes. The funding is available in 2014. We'll address many of the performance deficiencies and result, hopefully, in increased ridership, which is the goal, improved on-time performance and increased revenue and reduced customer complaints. In terms of the red and orange-blue line rehabs, they are in our 14-19 budget in our capital plan. It includes over $900 million to continue our work to rebuild that system. The work is critical to the safe and reliability operations of our total system, and we're proud of the outstanding progress that we've made on that over the last couple of years. There's still much to do. In terms of escalators and elevators, as Rob described, the proposed investment plan includes funding to replace or rehabilitate 158 escalators and 85 elevators over the next 6 years. That total investment is over $300 million. And then the paratransit contract, which I discussed earlier, we will invest about $117 million to provide an improved paratransit model that will work for our access customers, which actually reduces some operating costs, invests in some vehicle costs to make the service more reliable and better performance. In terms of service standards, in October, the board adopted new standards, which address hours of service, trip frequency, and rush hour rail car capacity. This budget provides rail service that is consistent with those adopted standards and provides our customers with predictable and dependable service. Focus on the customer. You heard Lynn's presentation here earlier. We are very obviously focused on the customer. We have business plans across the organization which reflect a whole host of customer service initiatives. Improved communication using all media like Metro Alerts, real-time bus signs beginning in FY13 going out to FY18, installing better signage in, for bus rail and access, improved responsiveness for our call centers, customer feedback program, improving customer relations skill sets, purchasing new vehicles, keeping the average vehicle life at our targeted levels in our fleet plans, and keeping the mean distance between failures at or below targeted levels. We also have improvements in our smart card auto load and credit card payments, which will continue into the out years. And as you know, we are poised to look at an open payment system, which will have a pilot in FY14, and we'll be coming back to the board describing the details of that. We've worked closely with all of our jurisdictions on that pilot. It will be 10 mezzanines and I believe 3 bus garages, one in each jurisdiction. So we'll be showing real time what the opportunity is for having people pay with some other card, additionally to the Smart Trip card, but an additional card, debit and credit, and phone technology. Excuse me. I have a cold. Silver Line. The revenue service on the Silver Line, as I said, will begin in December, and preparations are going very well for that, and the expansion of the capacity for 8-car trains as well. In terms of 8-car trains, currently Metro delivers both 6 and 8-car trains during peak service. To meet increasing ridership demand and alleviate overcrowding, increasing the number of 8-car trains requires additional infrastructure, which we have talked about, in 4 key areas. Electrical systems that power the trains, additional rail cars, which we are online to get, rail storage and maintenance capacities, and improved station and increased capacity. The budget proposal before you includes over $40 million in the 6-year period from 2014 to 2019 to upgrade in the power infrastructure necessary to accommodate increased 8-car train service. It also includes a $54 million down payment necessary to exercise the option for the 220 rail car expansions, new fleet that we have ordered. This investment positions Metro to significantly increase the rail system capacity to accommodate for 8-car trains in our future. And then finally, people and assets. This investment plan includes funds to replace approximately 100 buses and rehabilitate another 100 each year. We are anticipating continued improvement on bus mean distance between failures, a measure of reliability. We will also begin taking delivery on new rail cars to replace the 1000 series in 2015. We will make strategic prioritized investments by focusing on track, structure, rehabilitation, track circuits to achieve the largest safety and reliability gains. I mentioned earlier our efficiency initiative that kicked off this week. We will keep you informed of that progress and report back to you the results and our implementation plans and how it will inform our multi-year budgets in the future years. The last chart, well, one of the last charts, is our, what I call our scorecard. And this is our performance results, our KPIs. And they reflect the investment that we have in calendar year 2013 targets, and these targets actually have increased to 2014. So the one area, the KPIs that have increased are employee injury rates, or the targets have improved. Customer injury rates, crime rate, rail on-time performance, capital investment rate, and our positions filled. The KPIs are merely an indicator of our overall performance of our system. and one indicator. Our business plans include functional measures that allow us to track and monitor our progress on implementation of hundreds of the actions that we have to support the board-adopted strategic goals. And finally, I don't have to tell this board what the value of Metro is to the region. Now, you've had many discussions about it. We view that Metro has a great value to the region, as you can see here, in terms of job locations within rail stations. They're very valuable. Property values are higher when an entity is in close proximity of a Metro rail station. And the amount of value is over $200 billion in terms of property value near Metro Rail. Generates about $3.1 billion annually in tax revenues is our estimate. So the regional value of Metro should never be understated, and we always have that in our hindsight as we look at building our budgets and our plans. We did go out in this particular budget and had stakeholder involvement. We understood we had public hearings in three jurisdictions, and we also went on the website and had people comment on them. Most of the comments, and you'll see them here on the next couple of pages, but majority of the comments were very focused on the momentum and strategic plan. And that's the right thing, because if we have a strategic plan that our customers can understand, that our regions can understand, it gives us the roadmap to actually make those investments year to year to year, and we actually can show that progress. So we heard a lot of the comments, and all of the comments that were highlighted here, we have incorporated into business actions in our multi-year planning. So we have a few slides in the appendix. I'm almost on time, and I won't go through them, but I would be happy to answer any questions to discuss. And I have the team here, if I don't have any detail, and of course, Rob, happy to have answer any questions as you consider the movement of the adoption of this board, of this budget for your next board meeting at the end of this month. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kissel and Mr. Troop, for an excellent presentation. I'd like to see how many of you have questions just to kind of determine which approach is. Okay. So, actually, I'd like to ask one question before we begin. I know that this budget doesn't explicitly address situations like sequestration and the continuance of sequestration into the next fiscal year. That may affect ridership and our revenue if that does occur. Can you walk the board through kind of how we would deal with that situation so we're all clear?
Sure.
If it does happen, how will we react to that, and kind of the timetable
sure.
for how we would do that?
So the preliminary estimates, the sequestration is still occurring. And I know Mr. Downey had sent me some really good information that showed what some agencies, some big agencies, federal agencies, are looking to do in terms of furloughs. We actually mapped that against the assumption that we've made in our FY14 operating budget with regard to that. And actually, it came out pretty good. We assumed that the federal government would take 12 furlough days. And in the information that Mr. Downey had provided to me from the federal government, that was pretty high. And some agencies are not taking any furlough days. Some are taking 6, some are taking 14. So if you average it out, I felt pretty comfortable with the assumption that we made in terms of the furlough. Now, what that says is that we assume it's going to be a $10 million reduction in the revenue forecast that we had originally provided in the January budget. And based upon what we believe is most of that $10 million can be mitigated with offsetting cost actions and can be also dealt with internally with the budget that we have that we've adopted in January. I'm trying to think of a couple of issues, two items that we actually looked at. Yeah. So let me step the board specifically through how we came to the analysis. One of the first things that we did was look at our line item budget. Oh, thank you. I have to go through it. And I stepped through the board through this last month, but I'll go through it more specifically. So if I have a $10 million, say I'm in a $10 million hole in FY14 based upon what we had assumed, there's four actions that I would take that we feel pretty comfortable with. One is we would look at each of our line items in our budget. One of the line items that we continually have to try to align is services line item. So it's services contracts, consultants that we use, augmented staff, things like that. And I think in that particular line item, we may have room to reduce some of that, depending upon some of the negative effects that we could have on sequestration. And I think we feel comfortable with that, given the recruitment plan that we have in place, how we're actually moving employees into place and using probably less contractors. So that was the first step that we would take. We would look at our cost budget. The second step that we would take is we would look at our surplus that we would have for this year. I've mentioned in the past that we are probably going to be in a surplus of our budget in about $10 or $15 million range. Of course, that surplus should be used for a couple of items that I mentioned to the board before. One, I think it should be used to look at funding and benefit trust, because we have an OPEB liability, which is a very huge pending one in the future, and we have never pre-funded those types of things. And so that was one of the recommendations. That could be used, part of the money could be used for that. The other part could be used to offset any issues that we would have in our 14 budget. The third action that we would probably take is we would look at non-service related, non-operating related types of things that would have the least impact to our customer. One of the examples I gave last month was looking at station entrances and exits, and on a weekend or at night, determining whether or not we have, we could actually close one entrance versus another. Without having a safety issue, without having a crowd issue, it's something we can look at in our scheduling. And I think we feel confident that we can actually do that. I will say that on a $1.7 billion operating budget, I think I'm giving you my confidence that $10 million is something that we can actually manage, given the fact that over the last couple of years, we have come into a surplus of about $15 million. So that's how we would address it. I'm not recommending modifying the revenue forecast that we have. I don't know if Mr. Sarles mentioned this, but we had one of our highest ridership days. Was it April 10th?
Fourth
one in history, and that's on a weekday. So when you look at our revenue planning model, we don't plan that specific, that on a weekday we're going to have a high revenue ridership because cherry blossoms were late. So we have enough room in our revenue forecast to actually accommodate for some of those things that may happen.
Thank you. Before we move off this topic, are there any other questions related to sequestration issues? Yeah. Mr. Bulger.
Well, in yesterday's budget by the President, originally that 5.1% was the OMB estimate on sequestration for non-mandatory accounts, and that now they're saying as of just last night it's going to be 7.3% for FY 2014. So there's a variance of 5.1 versus 7.3. So I don't know if that's, and it's going in the wrong direction.
Right.
So that could affect more furlough days than originally envisioned.
Mm-hmm.
And then it keeps going and going and going. It doesn't end. And that's for, that kicks in October 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they change it.
Any other questions regarding the sequestration issue? If not, what I will do is work around the table just to make sure all members are heard, and we'll start with Mr. Nichols.
By the way, just one question just related to the ridership forecasting. Mm-hmm. And your confidence level in our forecasting for this next year, which obviously, notwithstanding impacts that happen for activities that we can't plan, but what is... Talk about that a little bit, because that's a significant impact on our budget.
Yeah, if you look at the to answer your question, if I'm asked about it, my confidence level, when we talk about this quite a bit, I always look at the last 5 or 6 years in terms of what ridership growth has happened and what kind of performance we've had on that. And if you look at 2006, 2007, actually even before that, we've had huge amounts of ridership increase in our system. As we started to get into 2008, we started to drop off a little bit, not as much growth. We were planning 3% increase in rail ridership, for example, in those years. What's happened is we've almost come to a capacity point. And if you look at that capacity point, it's for a variety of different reasons, because our system is only this big, and you know, we have 8-car trains, 6-car trains, and we're looking to invest in more so we can capture more of that ridership. That will happen into the out years. So I look at the revenue forecast for this year. I believe that they're, notwithstanding the sequestration, but I believe that they're pretty conservative. They're not 3% growth rates. They're less than one, as a percent and a half on both rail and bus. So I feel that, and then I'm looking at my bus ridership now, and I'm looking at rail ridership now, we will probably come into FY13 on plan on the bus ridership, slightly off on rail ridership. So I feel that we're at a capacity point in terms of our rail ridership. We're not going to plan for aggressive growth, but I think that the growth that we have planned in there is probably growth that we will see. Sequestration is an issue, but it's probably, you know, 35-40% of our riders. We have other riders, I mean, as seen by this week, when we had our highest ridership day, that was not on commuters, that was on tourists and people who are coming to visit our lovely city. So those are things that we don't necessarily, our forecasting doesn't detail those particular events, but when we have them, actually, they booster a lot of our ridership numbers. So.
And thank you very much. And just one other brief, less of a question than it is a request. I think the last slide that you showed, which talked about the impact of the system, the value of the system in the region in terms of the number of jobs within X miles, et cetera, and that's incredibly meaningful. It's very important, and I'm glad we're telling that story. I would suggest, though, that in addition to that data, particularly as we look forward at our planning and out years, an even more impactful or an additional impactful piece of data would be what level of economic development and growth is actually dependent upon meeting adequate public facilities requirements because of our in-place infrastructure. For example, if we've got 2 million jobs that are within a half million, within a half mile, there may be another million that can only be built and delivered because that facility allows them to meet those adequate public facilities tests. Mm-hmm. Or our expansion enables that growth. And I think in terms of why, of the value looking forward to the system, in terms of expanding and otherwise, the importance of demonstrating why without it we can't grow is important. And not only in terms of the rail, but particularly in terms of the bus hubs and how those systems and infrastructure meet adequate public facilities tests for that enable the development to occur. And maybe COG could draw that data out and make it available through their resources to you and without necessarily taxing our resources to generate it. But I think it's incredibly important information. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I failed to mention, and I will, I mean, obviously we have the Dulles line, our new line. So obviously we're having increased ridership because we're expanding our system, which plays a component to our ridership forecast as well. But a point taken on that.
Thank you, and my comments first, thank you for the presentation, and I think most importantly for the discussion that's gone on to get us to this point, because I think it has been a very positive way of us coming out at this point in time with our budget well adopted, and we're all seemingly in agreement here. Also, I just wanted to kind of, as you went to the point, the new slide says a new date on the Dulles Rail, and just to affirm that does not impact us in terms of service delivery as we see it today, that it is just what that December time versus the one day in January means.
Yes, I apologize. I'm of course, this, as a CFO, I'm looking at revenue service. So
sure. Yes, exactly.
I'm saying December is when I'm having revenue service, not necessarily the
right.
Operational activation plan dates. Those are different. That's correct. Thank you.
Okay. That's important.
Mr. Bolger, any further questions?
Yeah, I just wanted to explore why there's only two core capacity projects in this six-year plan, and Union Station and Gallery Place. What fell off the table or what didn't get in?
That's a great question. I'm not sure if I have a... Yeah, we'll have to come back. Rob can tell you, but we have...
There are, in the 2025 Momentum Plan, there are other station capacity projects, including connecting Metro Center and Gallery Place, Farragut North and Farragut West. But we felt the most critical were the ones that were mentioned earlier, Union Station, and the other one was? and Gallery Place in terms of some movement there from the red line to the yellow-green line. So that those are the most urgent ones, and that's why they're there. But as this is only a six-year plan, we've got a lot more six-year plans before we get to 2025. And I think you'll see in the decade starting in 2020, investment in the other areas.
We have $13.5 million in CIP 0039 core and system capacity project development. Is that enough to get these core capacity projects?
This is just the start.
Yeah, I know.
It's the start of the investment. In the six-year plan. It's just the start.
Okay, I'm just trying to see.
Yeah, what we tried to do
is jump start this sooner rather than later.
Well, they're working on the engineering for these types of things, and that's the first thing you have to do to lead to the project. These are not going to be simple projects, if you will, so it takes time. But this is what we're trying to demonstrate here, and we are demonstrating here, is we're beginning to make the investments for 2025, whether it's in planning for the longer-range stuff or engineering for the closer range.
All right, the last question, Mr. Chairman, I don't know where this fits in, but I got this thing called jurisdictional subsidy alternatives, and it's for FY 2014, and I don't understand it at all. I mean, I can't figure earned versus proportional, earned versus silver. I have no idea how you read this chart.
Okay, so let me try
to. Can someone explain this?
I can explain it to you, yeah, simply. We have a specific methodology that we allocate to each of the, by mode and also by jurisdiction, in order to determine what the jurisdiction of subsidy is going to be for any given year. And that's very prescribed. Mm-hmm. What you're speaking about here is one of the recommendations for the 14 budget was for the board to consider using last year's surplus, which if you recall was $30 million, to use to invest in this year's plan. And when we looked at how to allocate that surplus by the methodology that we use, we have done it two ways. And we have done it the way, as you say, the way it was earned. So if the surplus was a result of more rail, then rail would be the predominant factor on how it would be distributed across the jurisdictions. We have also distributed that surplus what we call proportionally. So we look at the weighted amount of subsidy that each jurisdiction pays, and then we just allocate it based on that weighting. Just to complicate matters, I think we had a third option for the board to consider, which was, maybe we'll use the surplus to offset the one-time expenses that we would have on the silver line, and we would allocate it that way because there wouldn't be any revenue offset. We've actually haven't proposed that option. So the option that we have proposed, and that's in the budget as you see here, is to allocate the surplus proportionally by jurisdiction. And I believe we have agreement. I know I have agreement with the district, with Virginia, and with Maryland. And I believe that's before you today, certainly to have discussion about it. But I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Mr. Belcher. Are there any other questions about the subsidy issue before we move on? I just want to make sure if we could follow up on this one. Ms. Belcher.
Yeah. Can you just clarify in this case how the subsidy was earned?
Subsidy, do you have it was earned? Do you have how it was earned? It was, on a high level, Ms. Bowser, it was earned probably more for rail. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Then the subsidy, actually, the original subsidy, there was a large access, the surplus.
And right? Surplus.
We're talking about the surplus,
yes,
excuse
that
me.
That was the surplus, or the $30 million surplus.
Yes, it was heavily weighted towards those jurisdictions that had access services. So Maryland had earned quite heavily. So the original proposal that we had in the GM's budget, we had displayed it to be distributed exactly the way it was earned. So it showed a heavy distribution to those jurisdictions that had access services.
Try to clarify because I see the. So Maryland has a large amount of access services, probably more so than, say, Virginia. And so a lot of that surplus that we had was a direct result of the fact that Christian did such a great job at developing eligibility, pre-eligibility procedures, and getting more people to ride, if they could, on our existing system. And so as a result of that, the jurisdiction that benefited from that mostly would have been Maryland in that situation.
Okay. Yeah. So in other words, Maryland paid a higher amount for Metro Access. So the savings achieved, there were more savings than Maryland achieved. But they've already paid for them. So we're talking about what would, you know, you could think of it as a refund. For
yeah, that's exactly
paid.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you could give that refund back proportionally. You could directly.
Right.
Actually.
That's right.
But you've decided to give it back proportionally based on.
Well, we're recommending that.
You're recommending the proportion is based on what?
It's based on the discussions that we've had with.
But what is the proportion?
The proportion is really just is how you apply the surplus based on the weighted amount of subsidy that is provided to each jurisdiction. So it's based on the weighted subsidy. That.
Okay. And so in that example, Maryland would get back less in that alternative than in the first alternative.
That's correct. And the discussions that we had have been with the JCC, with Maryland, Virginia, and the district.
Well, what about the district in that example? Does the district get back less in that scenario than it would in the first alternative?
The district would get back less in that scenario. That's correct. I think it's about 500,000. I don't have the exact number.
Ms. Hutchins.
As our budget indicated, we generally use one method to do this, but this is not an unusual piece again. Yeah. And might you explain the reason that happens? Because you may see Maryland maybe imbalanced at this time, but we've had the other experience. So I think that the role that we play jurisdictionally is to ensure that, first of all, our budget's covered, and we cover our budget by balancing those jurisdictionally, accepting the fact that there are times in which some will carry a greater weight than others, and that has worked out, I think, pretty equitably for us most of the time. It's these rare moments where we have the surplus piece that we agree to these solutions for. Yeah.
Okay. Do you have another subsidy question?
Just in terms of the subsidy thing, in this particular example, doing it a different way would result in more money coming back to Maryland. But Maryland supports the proposal that's in the budget because we believe that it would be consistent with what's been done in the past, and we would like to be consistent throughout.
Okay. The only other point I would add to that, too, is I think that it is it's an opportunity, and I think it's following precedents that we really do step back and understand the regional responsibility that we all play from a governance perspective. And it does, and it clearly would have meant a larger refund or otherwise to Maryland. But I think in this context, I think all of us recognize that when we have those opportunities to ameliorate costs throughout the region, that we take those opportunities. There may be times when it can't happen because of jurisdictional constraints, but I think in this particular case, particularly when we're talking about a subsidy as opposed to seeking new dollars, it made a lot of sense in this context based on the discussions I had with staff and otherwise. So it's but I appreciate the points that you're raising the question, importantly. And I think that the dialogue is important to have as well. But thank you.
Any other questions about our? Okay.
Silver line, thank Kevin. Okay, in percentage terms, is expressed as 103%. How could it be 103%? I don't understand that at all for the district. Here.
I guess, yeah. We can walk you through it. Well, we can do it simply.
Well, I don't understand. How do you get it past 100?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood you. I don't know what you're looking at.
Well, here, I'll do it.
Okay.
it's appendix.
I don't know. This was, I had it separate from something. It must have been some documents they sent out. I don't quite understand it either.
Yeah.
I don't know. A Bramada, I think.
Maryland did.
I understand.
It's a Maryland document.
Okay, yeah. So can we identify the source of this document? It's not in the budget proposal.
It's not in the
okay.
budget proposal. Yeah, I just want to make sure it's okay. not in your budget proposal. It's probably a piece of work that was provided, but Mark can now. Yes, I'm sorry.
He can explain the difference. Why don't you take my seat?
Wow.
The amount of subsidy just went down.
Yeah.
Okay.
So where did you get that?
Got it from the staff that we have for the District of Columbia.
I'm told that it originated from Maryland.
Okay, well, listen, I could try to explain that, but I will say it's not okay. in our budget materials here. So I want to clarify that because it's, you know, but we can try to explain it.
Okay.
You can.
Okay. Nice to be back in front of you again. I do recognize the numbers there for version 1, version 2, version 3. Version 1, again, is if we were to return the surplus to the jurisdictions as it's described in the audit adjustment that we do at the end of every fiscal year. Version 2 is what we're proposing, return the surplus in proportion to the net subsidy for rail and access and bus that each jurisdiction is going to pay in FY14. And then version 3 is if we were to allocate $25 million of that surplus specifically to offset Silver Line one-time startup expenses. So then the next two columns over there, and so as earned is sort of the default, let's just do it as the accounting department would have us do it, and then we're comparing the version 2 proportional approach to that as a baseline, and then comparing the version 3 Silver Line approach to that as a baseline. And so Carol's estimate was pretty close. She said a $500,000 difference for the district. It looks like it's actually about $700,000 difference if we use the proportional approach. If we were to use the Silver Line approach, that difference for the district would increase to about $1.4 million. And so then that last column that says the difference between those two alternative approaches, it looks to be about $700,000. And so I think that 103% looks like it's 696 divided by 675. So I think it's just saying the difference for the negative impact to the district of version would be it's 100% increase but I don't think that's necessarily the best way to say it. It's the impact on the district would go from 700,000 to 1.4 million. We are proposing version 2, the proportional approach, which is an approach that we've taken in the past,
right.
as a way to share the surplus across.
Yeah, and since a lot of the board members don't have the history, some do. We had the situation a few years when we were in a budget issue, and I think on the other side, I think it was Maryland who had an issue because of the growth in metro access, which was enormous and could not be contained, and. They had the issue on a budget year. They had a fiscal crisis, as we all did. And I think that they resolved it with Virginia and district. And that's when we set up the proportional precedent. And that we may have had it before that, too, but before my time. So we do have a precedent here. It's not something new that we're recommending. It's a recommended approach, which we believe we had agreement with. And I do believe we have agreement on.
That was certainly an understanding on our side of the river. So I think the operative point was Kathy's earlier that this has been, I think everybody is in agreement, and that's why I would hope we would move on.
May I speak to that question? And I don't know what conversations have gone on before this meeting, but this is a public meeting, and this is where the vote happens. So I don't know what agreements have been made, but I haven't agreed to anything. So I would just caution the staff not to, you know, present something as a fait accompli when, in fact, the only decisions that can be made here.
Let me make clear this is a recommendation. Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Downs.
Could I say that it's important to recognize that this has not been a perfect process. There were JCC discussions, as I understand it. There was a reluctance on the part of the JCC to come to an agreement without the full engagement of the jurisdiction representatives, the board members. I understand that there was an initial negotiation that started between Maryland and Virginia in order to see if there was a way to reach an accommodation about the major impact here, which was a shift from Maryland to Virginia and an agreement about those numbers, because it's in the several million dollar range, about Maryland agreeing to take a reduction in what would be returned to it, and having that accrue to Virginia. Somehow in the process, the district was not part of that first round of discussion at the staff level. I didn't find out about it until later, and apparently the jurisdiction staff in the district did not either. It was important to have some preliminary agreement about this, since the two major parties here, Maryland and Virginia, were in substantive agreement about this issue. I think it's important, though, to recognize that this has not been a perfect process. It's not been one that has allowed for full engagement at the staff level and at the board member level. So I understand Ms. Bowser's concern about the lack of full conversation until we got here. But I'm appreciative of Maryland's ability here to reach an agreement on the nature of a agreement of a couple of million dollars worth of subsidy allocation change in this process, about the $30 million to help solve a one-time problem within Virginia. And I think in terms of fairness and regional accommodation, that was, I think, the right decision, as Mr. Nichols has said, about recognizing regional responsibilities and accountabilities here. I'm just sorry that it didn't work out as perfectly as I would have hoped about, in particular, the district's participation in the final round of discussion.
And Mr. Nichols.
I would just add that the in the context of quote decision, the I respect Ms. Bowser's comments in terms of decisioning. I fully agree with that. The only all I would add in that regard is that the issue did require a lot of mental gymnastics on my part to understand. So I respect the questions you've raised, because it took me several conversations to fully understand exactly what is there and what the alternatives are. And so when we speak in terms of decisions, I had quite a bit of discussion with, the issue was raised with the Maryland board members, both the Maryland, Prince George's, Montgomery County board members, and I had substantive dialogue with the transportation team that supports our understanding of what we presume to get ready to do. And I do know that in my dialogue directly with them, they also had collateral discussion with the other jurisdictional representatives, staff representatives, to make sure that there was at least a consistent understanding of what would be recommended to the board. And so I was comfortable in that regard, recognizing that we had not had a dialogue about it, because particularly important, and Carol had raised this, in my mind, it's very important that the JCC really ferret out 99% of the issues of understanding, and when they require a board contribution to at least getting a sense that it might work, I think that's appropriate for that kind of a dialogue. But I respect the questions that have come up. Again, from a Maryland perspective, we are supportive of this proposal, and I respect the questions and concerns that have been raised. I think it's a fair and reasonable, regionally framed use of that resource. Thank you.
Ms. Hutchins, do you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay. Or comment. Okay. So I think we've, again, what we had been reviewing was a worksheet. Again, the general manager's proposal was on the worksheet version 2, which was really a proportional subsidy allocation. That is what the recommendation is of the staff. Again, this is still a decision that the board has to make, but I just wanted to clarify for the public what has been going on, because it probably was confusing to many. But the general manager's recommendation was basically version 2, the proportional budget subsidy scheme. Okay. Any other questions regarding that? If not, we'll move forward with Mr. Barnes, who had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick comment, then quick question. The comment is, this is my third time through budget process here at WMATA, and I would say it is vastly, vastly, vastly improved from where it was 3 years ago. And Carol, you and your whole team have, I think, really done a good job of improving the process. It's not perfect, as our chairman indicated. Nothing's perfect, but it is a huge sea change from what I saw when I arrived here. I think it's probably because you stole Tom from Maryland, and that's probably why it's so improved. My question is fiscal 14 budget includes improved lighting for 13 of our 86 stations. When can we project that all 86 of them are likely to have improved lighting? And when are we going to see that terrific Bethesda station that you showed in the video? When can our passengers begin to think about having that dream come true?
The Bethesda station is a staged approach. Obviously, we'll be doing some, you know, lighting improvements in there. The escalator improvements will be continuing through 14. By the end of fiscal year 15 is when we expect to have the entire station done. In that regards, in regards to the lighting, that the reality is we're looking at 24 mezzanine lightings for the underground stations. So we're focusing on the mezzanines for the underground station as well. Depending on the ability to do track rights, we might be able to progress that a little bit quicker. So, you know, staff I've been challenging staff to be able to get efficiencies out of that. And we have basically standard designs that we developed at Judy Square, which can apply to all but 6 of the underground stations. The other remaining 6 will have to be specialized designs, with the concept being the same about the linear lighting. Our challenges with the station lighting, the mezzanines aren't quite as challenging, but the trackbed lighting is. Trackbed lighting requires a significant amount of track time to get in there. There's a lot of deterioration that occurred along the trackbed lighting's elements. So getting in there and doing 2 things. First of all, replacing it, but also replacing it with more robust systems. You know, is important so that we don't have the same kind of deterioration through the years. So that's one of our challenges with that. But, you know, obviously, you know, we're focused on the underground stations first. You know, our expectation is, I believe, if I have this correct, but through fiscal year 15, we should be able to get all of this, all the underground stations done. I'm getting a nod yes over there. So,
Mr. Downey, you have a quick question? No. You have a quick question, Mr. Downey?
I have a question. I don't know what.
Yeah, we're trying to go. You're just going around the vendor. Ms. Porter?
Thank you. And thank you for very helpfully putting up the slide I was just going to ask about. We've talked a lot about the Metro 2025 initiative and comparing it to what's in the current budget. I wonder if you could clarify on 2 elements. And one is the 8-car trains, and the other is the priority corridor network. If you could explain how much of what we, in other words, if we take what's in the current budget, how much 8-car trains will we get, and how much of the priority corridor network will we get without the additional funding that we're asking for the near term?
In the for the 8-car trains in the current budget, what we have is a down payment on 220 expansion cars in the 6-year program. That is a result of the fact that we have options within the 7K with Kawasaki. We can exercise certain options. It's important to us for to take advantage of those contract efficiencies. Anytime you put a rail car procurement out, there's about $100 million that are in startup costs, engineering costs, production costs, startup production costs that are then obviously taken across value of the cars. So we have an opportunity here to really exercise a lot of efficiency of about, I think it's $2.8 million a car that we are being able to exercise. If we were to wait and go out with another contract outside of the options that we have available to us, that would increase significantly, maybe to like 3.5. So under this plan, this is simply a down payment. This is to exercise those options by contract that we have available to us.
So if we don't get the additional funding, we will not, in fact, get those cars. This is the down payment.
Well, we have options. We have options for those. If we don't get the funding, we have the midlife rehab or on the 2-3K cars, or not the mid, excuse me, we have the 2-3K cars would have to be replaced at some point, so we would be able to shift money around for those. We do have contingency plans moving forward with the 220 expansion cars if we don't get the funding that we know we would have to have. We'd have to be able to exercise regardless for the funding.
So without the – let me just put it a different way. Without the additional funding, would we be able to run all 8-car trains?
No, we would not.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct. Without the additional funding, we would not be able to run 100% 8-car trains. I want to be clear, too, that it includes not only the cars – but it includes the facilities to store the cars, the heavy repair facility that we need to do, the additional storage yards on those. So it is a significant effort moving forward.
Okay, and what about on the bus priority corridor network?
On the priority corridor network, of course, it's been a multi-year project. We're continuing to move along. We are probably in the area of 40% of the implementation of the priority corridor from the standpoint of service. Probably 25 to 30% when it comes to the other amenities that we would hope that would exist along the corridors. This year's budget has $4.4 million of investment in priority corridors, and we look forward to making improvements in the off hours and the evenings and weekends to expand the capabilities along these corridors.
So without the additional funding, we'd get maybe 40% of the priority corridor networks we've identified as getting the expanded service.
We're at 44% of the services in place. We're trying to move that up closer to 50 with this year's investment.
Okay, so but if we didn't get the additional money, the 2025 money.
Well, okay. Well, I think what we're trying to do with the proposals within the budget is inch along into 2025, and that this investment in this year's budget is part of the overall momentum concept. And, we're trying to – there's so much demand for these services that we're trying to squeeze out as much of an investment as we can, complementary to the whole momentum program.
Unlike the rail car procurement, which is a very long lead time, and you have to start making a down payment now to get cars, 5-6 years from now, the bus side is a little bit more flexible. So if you don't get the additional money, we have money in the base plan for priority corridor networks, but in the Metro 2025, we go above and beyond that as we connect more communities. Those kind of investments are buying buses, priority, some traffic, priority signalization improvements, that sort of thing. There's a lot less lead time. So if we don't get the additional funding that we're looking for Metro 2025, we just won't do it. Simple. It's not. We don't have to make the down payments like we do long in advance on the rail cars.
Okay, I guess let me just say it a different way. So if we don't get the 2025 funding,
additional funding,
mm-hmm. we could still do the priority corridors that we've got on the plan now, but we could do more of them
if we got
the additional funding.
Yes.
Got it. Thank you.
Ms. Hines.
Thank you. This is the page I wanted to bring up, too. So, and I'm focused on the Blue Line connection, which is certainly the talk of the town in my part of the world, and unless you're talking about Columbia Pike, then we have more talk of the town. But Blue Line connection is, in fact, the big thing. And so I'm looking at a $1 million investment over 6 years, if I'm reading this right. to get us to something we might be able to construct for 2025. And I just am really questioning that $1 million as all that is in the six-year plan, because I've been involved enough to know that the planning for these things is never $1 million out of a $1.5 billion possible cost. And we are most interested in this being able to start to be operationalized and constructed. So what can you tell me about that?
Let me talk about it. So it's really just it's the investment that we have currently for the planning. Is it low? I mean, the fact of the matter is we've actually already invested in some work, so it's not like it's starting new. So this is just the additional investment that we have to make in order to complete the studies associated with these the two, the blue line and the other pocket track phase.
But it's so, $1 million total from 2014 to 2019.
I think when we look at the 2025 plan and the extent of the project, what we do is we say, okay, at what point do we want to finish the project, and then we move backwards from that. So what we're doing is this enables us to do the upfront planning in regards to, you know, doing the conceptual designs, making sure that the, you know, whether or not, you know, that the level of the EIS that has to be done on it, obviously, being able to, you know, look at impacts and other things, scheduling impacts and everything. And then at the end of the six-year plan is when, once that has been developed, then that's when we would really say, okay, this is when we're going to start investing in it. And we look at it as about, you know, like I said, between a, you know, five- and six-year kind of time frame for that. So we don't want to get too far ahead of it. But we know that we really don't want to do it until about, you know, the 2025 time frame to when we could actually start this work. So
I'm confused. I thought the goal here was that this would be available in 2025.
That's correct.
So it's probably a 2 to 3 year construction project, if not more. But there's decisions to be made about which option we're choosing and a variety of other things. And you really think you can do that with $1 million?
Again, this is what, in the existing budget, we start the planning. Metro 2025 calls for, on average, $500 million or more a year over 10 or 12 years to get everything done. This just starts the planning. Is it all the money we're going to spend on planning? Probably not. Certainly not the money we're going to spend on engineering for this sort of thing. But this starts it. If we're successful in getting the additional funding that we need for Metro 2025, then we can step up the pace. But the construction itself will be after 2020, in that 2020 to 2025 period.
So I guess partly this is continuing to make the point that I think Mrs. Porter started out on, which is some of these things which people really desire are not indeed possible unless we find, as a region, that extra $500 million a year.
You got it.
That moves us along. So yep. So we all kind of keep want to make continue to make that point. The other question that I would like to ask, if I might, and perhaps is more appropriate for customer service, but I just want to make sure that we're all clear about it. We had quite a conversation last year as we finished up the budget related to the folks who use Metro Access's ability to, when they call in or go on the website, to make a strategic choice about their trip time in order to manage their costs. And we haven't heard anything lately, and I know this was a big ask in terms of all the programming and stuff, but I really am hoping that we're going to get there. And I don't know whether that's a budget issue or just a get-there issue.
Actually, that's not a budget issue,
okay,
because we're internally developing, I think we called it the FAIR calculator. I think we're calling it something different now. And Kevin Borok, a CIO, and his team are developing that. I believe the last time it has been a long time since we talked about it, but we're scheduled to complete it in June. So it's not a budget issue. It'll certainly be a communication plan that we'll have to work with Lynn and her team on, and then and we'll work with the ACS community to roll that out. So we're on schedule for that.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Dr. Tong, any questions?
I just want, Carol, I wondered if you could highlight the human capital investments in this budget.
The human capital, there's two initiatives I would say, and Tanya can, she's probably more, but I'll talk about the system and then the other. And actually, there's three. So the system investment that we're making, and it's in this budget, is to upgrade our enterprise human capital system. As you can imagine, we have systems that recruit people, that help recruit people, talent, development. We have 8,000 people that we have to record what their training is, and then it actually helps us develop what new training they need to have. That project is being led by under my organization, IT, and under Tanya's, and they will be completed in phase one, and she'll probably tell you more about it, in FY14. So that's the system side of it. I think that's going to help us quite a bit. Underneath the system side of it is going to be process improvements, as you can imagine, because if you're doing things in a manual way, that's not optimal. And so there'll be a lot of process improvement associated with that that can really affect how we understand training, understand how we should invest in people who need new training, and we have a consolidated area to look at that. It affects safety. It affects every aspect of our organization in that respect. So that's the process of the planning. I'll have Tanya speak about the other areas that she's investing in.
Yes. Good morning. Oh, is it on? Yes. A number of initiatives that we're going to implement in FY14 is the beginning of the succession planning program. We will develop, design, and implement an initial succession planning pilot. Once we evaluate the pilot, then in FY15, I believe we will be recommending the full investment of initiating the full-blown program. Another thing that we'll be implementing is metro-wide competency architecture. We will define and implement core behavioral competencies to be included in both the recruitment process as well as the performance management program. The performance management program is underway now. We are in the process of implementing that, and we will use that system at the end of this calendar year for the CY13 performance evaluations. The training is being initiated now. The forms are being finalized. Another thing that we're going to be designing is a program for first-level supervisors and managers to develop a design and develop core competencies and management training for that specific group. One of the other things that we'll be doing is, or that we're already doing, is following up on the employee engagement survey. We are in the process of developing action plans, the overarching plans, which we will come back to the board in the near future to talk about where we are with that, as well as the department action plans to address those issues, and that will be an ongoing project. And the other thing that we will be implementing in terms of human capital management is an employee wellness program. So those are the initiatives, and next month I will be coming before the board to give you a full presentation on those initiatives.
Thank you.
Thank you for raising the issue. I'd like to make a suggestion. One of the things that we've talked about a lot is that we have to start making a lot of human capital investments in the system. We have a physical capital budget. The human capital budget of the authority on the operating side is about 70% of the entire authority's budget. Having a unified human capital budget with all of the elements that we're going to get briefed on later, but wellness, succession planning, skills training, recruitment, discipline, all of the fringe issues, health care cost, pension cost, retiree cost, seem to fit in a lot of organizations within a human capital budget, where they have specific performance criteria and performance measures that help guide the investment of funds and focus on outcomes. And not for this year's budget, but now that we're talking about a much broader array of human capital investments, perhaps recognizing that as part of the large picture budget of having a human capital budget that gives it the kind of the equal weight of the capital budget, because they are our resources, that these people deliver our services, and recognizing that I think would help the board have a better sense of accountability and performance. So Thanks for raising the issue, Art.
Mr. Dyke, any questions?
Just one. Can you explain a little bit about what kind of contingencies we have in here as the impact on our ongoing discussions with respect to pension and retirement and all those other related labor matters?
Yes. In this particular budget, there are no wage increases assumed. We have no wage increases in this year budget, and we have no wage increases in next year's budget. The general manager's perspective and direction is to, if there are efficiencies that have been developed where we have been more effective or we're more operational efficient, then he would consider possibly increases for non-represented employees. And our union employees, and that hasn't been determined, but our union employees, we have no reserve in our budget for any wage increases in that regard. So there is a risk associated with that. We also have a reserve that the board directed us, not a reserve, but we included a $2 million one day we would be closed or shut down. And we included, I think it was $2 million in our budget, assuming we'd have a shutdown day. In terms of pension, we pay as you go. So we fund pensions, and the pensions are funded, our contribution to that in FY14, as much as we're fully aware based on our actuarials. Of course, if the market performance is better than expected, then that could be, you know, a benefit on the other side.
Mr. Downey.
Go.
I'm sorry, Mr. Downey. I'm sorry, Mr.
I'll talk to you offline.
I just wanted to share the view that this has been a great process, a great improvement over prior years, not only the communication at the meetings, but between meetings and the questions that have been answered. I think we know a lot more than we have known and sometimes in the past. I do have to say that some of what I know doesn't leave me completely comfortable where we are, particularly on the ridership side. I think it's a good thing that we are taking a reserve with respect to weather and shutdowns, but we've seen more and more of those and more of the partial shutdowns, so I think we need to track that. As Mr. Bolger pointed out, the sequestration, if it continues, and note that the President's budget says let's find other ways to close that gap, but if sequestration continues, next year it will be at the rate of 7.2% as opposed to 5.1%, because this year other means were taken to close about a quarter of it, so we'll get hit harder. And I think we have not yet seen in any degree the impact that we'll have throughout the economy of the region, contractors, consultants. I think those jobs are also going to be going away. Jobs that are supporting NIH, other activities throughout the region will be affected. So I think during the year, knowing that you do have some alternative ways to go, we should be watching very, very closely to be able to take the actions that we may have to take. I'd also note that the budget assumes that the transit benefit will continue, and we all hope that that will be the case, but there's no assurance that come January 1, 2014, it will still be in place. So I think it bears really close watching over the coming year.
Thank you, Mr. Downey. Ms. Dowdy?
Just quickly thank the staff for all of your work and presenting a budget to us. I wanted to ask about, and I'll talk to the chairman about perhaps coming back with a later presentation on the impacts of major procurements that are in front of the authority. Speaking specifically about this changing fare system that you're still contemplating that's out there, and if there's any impact in this plan.
We're in the procurement phase now, so we will be coming back and briefing you shortly on that. So I think scheduled for executive session next one coming up, 2 weeks.
Okay, but that is included in this budget.
Yes,
the ability to be able, and just in the future, I know that some of these things have been cooking for a while, and I think it would be helpful if we had a presentation on some of the major projects that are out there in a future meeting. Also, I want to thank you for your focus on the additional officers. I know you're two. Are you? Has that study about our staffing level for police concluded?
Not yet. I think they're doing the next few weeks.
Okay. So this 32, there was a 32 that are in the current year and 32 next year?
There was money in the budget to hire a police officer for the Silver Line as well as for additional bus security. One number was 32. I think the other was in the 20s somewhere. But they're both budgeted.
But was one for this current year?
26 was.
The bus security?
It actually started in fiscal year 13, the hiring of them. Fiscal year 14 continues that budget, obviously.
Okay, so there's not a net of 60.
There's not a there's 26 plus 32, that's 58.
Right.
Net new officers from where we were 6-7 months ago.
Okay, so that includes the additional bus and Silver Line rail.
Yes.
Okay. And thank you. And I know it's not a perfect science to know how many officers we need, and I will look forward to what the study says. Finally, are there any, is there a line item that shows what we're doing to help with pedestrian and bus access to our stations and bus stops? Yes. I know there's just generally, and I could talk about the specifics later, but I just, all of our patrons walk at some point to get to our facilities, and I just want to be mindful that the authority is doing all it can, that the jurisdictions are working with you to make access to our stations safer. And this is going to seem like a light question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I know that we have an art program in the authority, and are we also committed to public art at our stations with this budget? It's on level. What type of investment is it?
We'll get back to you with the number.
Okay, yeah, that one. And if I could, Mr. Chairman, just finally, and I'm happy to hear that we're going to get a human resources presentation at the next meeting, and I don't know there's a budget implication here, but I'm hopeful that that presentation could include a description or some discussion about what the Metro testing protocols are for hiring. If you could just summarize for us what those are in that presentation, that would be helpful.
To Ms. Bowser, Mr. Downs.
I know we're scheduled for a fair system brief on the procurement. I was glad to see that you listed this under the improved regional mobility and connect communities. We've had some difficulty in trying to define what that value / strategic objective is. And I'm glad to see that the improved automatic fare collection system is in that part of the strategic plan. One of the concerns that was raised in my mind was reading the 48 questions that the JCC had submitted to staff about the relationship of this procurement to each of the 12 other transit service providers in the region and their ability to be fully comfortable about this being a regional system, not just a Metro fare collection system. And at some points along the way in answering the questions, it said, well, if other providers want to, they can make their own decisions about either participating or not, which is true. But it was also kind of in the context a bit of they can kind of take it or leave it. I want to make sure that in the process of going through this round of investments, which I think is critical, not just for the authority, but for the region, that this is truly an all-encompassing regional system, and that we bend over backwards, publicly and privately, with the other service providers to make sure that every concern they've had, every issue they've raised, we've struggled mightily to solve for them and have them be perceived as a customer as well in this process.
Yeah, we've been very cognizant of that from the very beginning on this. There's an advisory committee that comprises representative of all the agencies that could potentially take advantage of this. It's part of the procurement process. We'll be glad to address that in the executive session because it influences the procurement. But I can assure you that on a regular basis, they have been providing advice, expressing concerns, and there's been an attempt to address all those concerns. We'll be glad to go through that.
Good.
Johnny, a quick follow-up. Quick follow-up to that. For those of us who are not blessed with representation on the JCC, it would be helpful if those products are shared more widely with the other board members.
Yeah, so we do have, we reach out to VRE, Amtrak, the FTA. We do it.
Yep. Be
helpful to more widely. Oh, I
understand. Not other board members, it's the advisory committee we've been working with. Okay. We'll present the entire board in the exec session. Yeah.
The other is a question about, I understand why you're proposing to remove the CNG capital project from Shepherd Parkway, and I guess that means that at least for a long time, there will be no CNG capacity at Shepherd Parkway, and that that means that only diesel or clean diesel or hybrids can be stationed at Shepherd Parkway, and that was not the initial plan for that facility. Does that have an implied operating cost going forward in the change in the fleet mix?
Well, actually, we have not given up on CNG. It may not just be at Shepherd Parkway. As we all know, we're trying to develop other new facilities like Cinderbed, Southern, and that sort of thing. And we are exploring the costs to bring CNG to those types of sites. And it varies. But the goal that we've told the board before is to be roughly 50-50. Between CNG and hybrids as we retire buses. That's still our goal. So while Shepherd Parkway, because of the economics of it, may not be the site of it, we have other opportunities, and we're really working pretty hard to make that work.
My major comment was concerning CNG, and Tom asked that question. I had talked with the CEO concerning the 50-50 mix. The district is very interested in having a fast fill CNG capacity within the district.
I think Mr. Nichols had another question.
Yes, thank you. This question actually relates to a question that Ms. Bowser had a moment ago related to our capital projects for improving access, pedestrian access to our buses, and certainly this is it's a major problem throughout our system, particularly for persons with disabilities, but persons without disabilities access. I wanted to bring to your attention, I had a fascinating discussion last week with the Maryland Secretary of Corrections, Gary Maynard, and Secretary of Housing, Skinner, and wanted to bring forward a model that they've used there. It's called the restorative justice model, which has had some real success in meeting some needs, and it may have some applicability here or with some of our jurisdictions where our residents of some of the correctional facilities are trained and actually are deployed in a managed environment to actually implement the concrete work, curb cuts, those kinds of things. It's been very successful. It has a lot of side core community benefits in terms of creating job skills, creating confidence and helping people in transitioning out of those facilities. I was fascinated by it. He's going to provide some information, and I will share it with you and the other jurisdictions. It could be a real opportunity, perhaps, to add value to the system and add a lot of value in so many other different areas. So it's a really exciting program.
Any other questions for the staff? Before you is a resolution to approve the FY 2014 budget. That is on page 40 of your packets. I would like to entertain a motion to move this forward.
So moved.
Moved by Ms. Dowser. Second by Mr. Dyke. Any discussion regarding the resolution or other questions regarding the budget before we move forward? If not, I will call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The resolution is approved. And we'll be forwarded to the committee, to the full board next in 2 weeks. Okay, with that concludes our agenda for today. I will note that the human capital plan will be on the next agenda in May, as well as a bus ridership report. But then I thank the committee for your patience with respect to the adoption of this budget, and the meeting is adjourned.